This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Carl Sagan once wrote, "We are the only species on the planet, so far as we know, to have invented a communal memory stored neither in our genes nor in our brains. The warehouse of this memory is called the library." This summer, NPR is exploring the idea of public libraries and their place in American life. And our film critic, Bob Mondello, asked if he could broaden that mandate a little to look at the library's place in America's fantasy life.
When I was 9 years old, I spent a lot of time at a public library just down the street because it had a well-stocked theater section, not just books, but original cast Broadway albums. And one day, a new one came in, The Music Man, about a salesman who was crazy about a girl named
Marion.
The head librarian had recommended it, and the next words explained why.
Madam Librarian.
I just assumed our librarian, who was maybe 23, was a spinster because she was so much older than my babysitters. Later, I found out the Music Man was spoofing that idea.
I love you madly, madly, Madam Librarian, Marion.
Spinster librarian is a literary construct and hardly the only one I picked up from pop culture. Librarians as detectives, libraries as fortresses protecting us from ignorance, whole science fiction worlds devoted to the storage of ideas and history, like the deserted planet in an early episode of Star Trek that seemed the only remaining trace of an entire civilization.
This appears to be an archive or library of some kind.
And we're certainly in the right place to find out where the inhabitants are and if there are any left now.
Well, that's fine. Where do we start?
I am the librarian. May I be of assistance?
Perhaps you can.
Mr. Atos.
As in A to Z.
I confess that I'm a little surprised to see you, but the surprise is a pleasant one. After all, a library serves no purpose unless someone is using it.
It's hardly surprising that writers, who deal all the time with words, would find fascination in great repositories of them. Borges imagining the universe as the Library of Babel, containing all possible books. Neil Gaiman stocking Lucian's library in the comic book series The Sandman, with every volume anyone has ever dreamed of writing but never written. George Lucas imagining holobooks and data sticks for his Jedi Temple library, and a whole universe's worth of knowledge,
the library,
stored in Doctor Who.
So big it doesn't need a name. Just a great big the.
It's like a city.
It's a world. Literally, a world. The whole core of the planet is the index computer. Biggest hard drive ever. And up here, every book ever written. Whole continents of Jeffrey Archer, Bridget Jones, Monty Python's Big Red Book.
We're near the equator, so this must be biographies!
These are all otherworldly libraries, not much resembling ones where you can actually check out a book. But pop culture is dotted with those, too, sometimes pictured as dreadful dead ends, as in It's a Wonderful Life.
Please, Clarence.
You're not going to like it, George.
Where is she?
She's an old maid. She never married.
Where is Mary? Where is she?
She's just about to close up the library!
That spinster librarian thing again, a fate worse than death, right? Happily, that was the same year an eager young bibliophile was haunting her local bibliothèque in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
I've read all the authors beginning with A and all the B's down to Burton. It's next.
You mean you're trying to read your way straight through the library?
Yes, ma'am.
But a book like this, you'll only be confused.
Please, I want to read clear through the alphabet. I want to know everything in the world.
Knowing everything in the world would make her a librarian, more or less. They know so much, in fact, that they can even beat computers, or at least Katharine Hepburn could in 1957's Desk Set. Admittedly, while she could quote Longfellow from memory, she was also a little high-strung.
Why, what a tasty little firefly. Little flitting white fire insect. Little dancing white fire creature. You're welcome.
Miss Watson, here's that $5 I borrowed.
Thank you, Ruthie. You can keep it if you need it. I don't want it. I will gladly wait till payday. On the shores of Gitche Gumee.
The notion of librarians as obsessive, almost devout about books, leads naturally to connections between religion and libraries. In literature, that's reflected in, say, the illiterate monks in A Canticle for Leibowitz, who archive what's left of civilization after an atomic war. Or in The Name of the Rose, a medieval mystery in which a Franciscan friar realizes a series of priestly suicides may be related to what cannot be found in the monastery's library.
Did you notice how few books there were on the scriptorium shelves? All those scriveners, copyists, translators, researchers, thinkers. Well, where are the multitude of books that they need for their work, And for which this abbey is famed? Where are the books?
Name of the Rose turned its library into a maze in both a literal and a literary sense, providing fun for readers and lending the stacks an air of excitement they don't always possess. That complements the cool factor teen fiction has bestowed on libraries that often have a little something extra. The dragon section Harry Potter could consult at Hogwarts, for instance. The towering bookshelves Belle fell for before she fell for the Beast who owned them. The archive where Batgirl was a librarian. And, of course, the school library, perched atop a hellmouth at Sunnydale High, where the point is less getting students to read than giving them the tools to fight for their lives.
Do you have any more copies of Emily Dickinson? I need one.
Buffy, while the mere fact of you wanting to check out a book would be grounds for a national holiday, I think we should focus on the problem at hand.
I'm sorry, you're right. Vampires.
What better spot to look up garlic recipes, right? There are few weapons more powerful than facts and ideas, and as libraries are full of those, they naturally appeal to firebrands. Playwright August Wilson, for instance, who wrote Fences, The Piano Lesson, and the 8 other plays in a decalogue that is among the crowning achievements of the American theater. As a 60s teenager, Wilson practically lived at his local library, which turned out to be great for his writing, less great for his grades. He penned one paper on Napoleon that was so well researched, his history teacher rejected it.
He didn't think I had written it. I tore a paper up, threw it in his wastebasket, and walked out of the school. I was 15 years old. I did not go back.
Where he went instead, avoiding truant officers while getting a good enough education to later satisfy the Pulitzer judges, was Pittsburgh's public library.
Love in the library, quiet and cool. Love in the library, there are no rules.
Germaine Greer wrote that a library is a place where you can lose your innocence without losing your virginity. And songwriters have joined poets and philosophers to offer their own takes on that notion, from Jimmy Buffett in this song to Tori Amos, who on her album Tales of a Librarian arranged the tracks according to the Dewey Decimal System. In songs and books and movies and art, libraries are sanctuaries, places of bustling quiet, storehouses of ideas that fuel the imagination. A wise man once said, "When you are growing up, there are two institutional places that affect you most powerfully: the church, which belongs to God, and the public library, which belongs to you." That wise man was Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones, who ran up thousands of dollars in overdue book fees. Don't believe me? I know where you could look it up. I'm Bob Mandela.